ethnography collection, Patterns of Culture. Apollonian cultures are said to be thinking, self-controlled, rational, logical, and ordered. Dionysian cultures are said to be feeling, passionate, instinctual, irrational, and chaotic. Few anthropologists invoke the dichotomy today, but a quantitative analysis of the world's cultures by the sociologist Geert Hofstadter has rediscovered the distinction in the pattern of survey responses among the middle-class citizens of more than 100 countries. According to Hofstadter's data, countries differ along six dimensions. One of them is long-term versus short-term orientation. Long-term oriented societies foster pragmatic virtues oriented toward future rewards, in particular saving, persistence, and adapting to changing circumstances. Short-term oriented societies foster virtues related to the past and present, such as national pride, respect for tradition, preservation of face, and fulfilling social obligations. Another dimension is indulgence versus restraint. Indulgence stands for a society that allows relatively free gratification of basic and natural human drives related to enjoying life and having fun. Restraint stands for a society that suppresses gratification of needs and regulates it by means of strict social norms. Both, of course, are conceptually related to the faculty of self-control, and not surprisingly, they are correlated with each other, with a coefficient of 0.45 across 110 countries. Elias would have predicted that both of these national traits should correlate with the country's homicide rates, and the prediction turns out to be true. The citizens of countries with more of a long-term orientation commit fewer homicides, as do the citizens of countries that emphasize restraint over indulgence. So the theory of the civilizing process, like the theory of the expanding circle, has found support in experiments and data sets that are far from its field of origin. Psychology, neuroscience, and economics have confirmed Elias's speculation that humans are equipped with a faculty of self-control that regulates both violent and nonviolent impulses, that can be strengthened and generalized over the lifetime of an individual, and that can vary in strength across societies and historical periods. So far, I have not mentioned yet another explanation for the long-term growth of self-control, that it is a process of evolution in the biologist's sense. Before turning to the last two of our better angels, morality and reason, I need to spend a few pages on this vexed question. Recent biological evolution? Many people casually use the word evolution to refer both to cultural change, that is history, and to biological change, that is, a shift in the frequencies of genes across generations. Cultural and biological evolution can certainly interact. For instance, when tribes in Europe and Africa adopted the practice of keeping livestock for milk, they evolved genetic changes that allowed them to digest lactose in adulthood. But the two processes are different. They can always be distinguished, in theory, by experiments in which babies from one society are given up for adoption and brought up in another. If biological evolution has taken place in response to the distinctive culture of either society, then the adopted children should differ, on average, from their native peers. A frequently asked question about declines in violence is whether they can be attributed to recent biological evolution. In a society that has undergone a pacification or civilizing process, has the genetic makeup of the people changed in response, helping the process along, and leaving them permanently less disposed to violence? Any such change would not, of course, be a Lamarckian absorption of the cultural trend into the genome, but a Darwinian response to the altered contingencies of survival and reproduction. The individuals who happen to be genetically suited to the changed culture would out-reproduce their neighbors and contribute a larger share of genes to the next generation, gradually shifting the population's genetic makeup. One can imagine, for example, that in a society that was undergoing a pacification or civilizing process, a tendency toward impulsive violence would begin to pay off less than it did in the days of Hobbesian anarchy, because a hair trigger for retaliation would now be harmful rather than helpful. The psychopaths and hotheads would be weeded out by the Leviathan and sent to the dungeons or gallows, while the empathizers and cooler heads would bring up their children in peace. Genes that fortified empathy and self-control would proliferate, while genes that gave free rein to predation, dominance, and revenge would ebb. Even a cultural change as simple as a shift from polygyny to monogamy could, in theory, alter the selective landscape. Napoleon Chagnon documented that among the Yanomamo, the men who had killed another man had more wives and more children than the men who had never killed. Similar patterns have been found in other tribes, such as the Jivaro, Shuar, of Ecuador. This arithmetic, if it persisted over many generations, would favor a genetic tendency to be willing and able to kill. A society that has shifted to monogamy, in contrast, removes this reproductive jackpot and conceivably could relax the selection for bellicosity. Throughout this book, I have assumed that human nature, in the sense of the cognitive and emotional inventory of our species, has been constant over the 10,000-year window in which declines of violence are visible, and that all differences in behavior among societies have strictly environmental causes. That is a standard assumption in evolutionary psychology, based on the fact that the few centuries and millennia in which societies have separated and changed are a small fraction of the period in which our species has been in existence. Since most adaptive evolutionary change is gradual, the bulk of our biological adaptation must be to the foraging lifestyle that prevailed during those tens of millennia, rather than to the specifics of societies that have departed from that lifestyle and diverged from each other only recently. The assumption is supported by evidence for the psychic unity of humankind, that people in every society have all the basic human faculties such as language, causal reasoning, intuitive psychology, sexual jealousy, fear, anger, love, and disgust, and that the recent mixing of human populations has revealed no qualitative innate differences among them. But the assumptions of ancient adaptation and psychic unity are only assumptions. The speed of biological evolution depends on many factors, including the strength of the selection pressure, that is, the average difference in the number of surviving offspring between the carriers of two variants of a gene, the demographics of the population, the number of genes required to implement a change, and the patterns of interaction among the genes. Though a complex organ built by a suite of many interacting genes can take eons to evolve, a quantitative adjustment that can be implemented by one gene, or a small number of independently acting genes, can take place over just a few generations, as long as they have large enough effects on fitness. Nothing rules out the possibility that human populations have undergone some degree of biological evolution in recent millennia, or even centuries, long after races, ethnic groups, and nations diverged. Though people sometimes write that hypotheses about natural selection are just so stories that can never be verified until someone invents a time machine, in fact, natural selection is a distinctive mechanistic process that leaves signs of its handiwork both in the design of organisms' bodies and in the patterning of their genomes. Since the completion of the first phase of the Human Genome Project in 2000, the search for fingerprints of selection has been one of the most exciting research activities in human genetics. One technique juxtaposes the human version of a gene to its counterpart in other species and compares the number of silent changes, which have no effect on the organism and so must have accumulated by random drift, with the number of changes that do have an effect and thus may have been a target of selection. Another technique looks at the variability of a gene across individuals. A gene that has been subjected to selection should vary less among individual people within the human population than it does between humans as a whole and other mammals. Still other techniques check to see whether a gene lies in the middle of a big chunk of chromosome that is identical across people, the sign of a recent selective sweep, which carries a stretch of a chromosome along for the ride with the handy gene before mutations have had a chance to adulterate it, or sexual recombination has had a chance to shuffle it into pieces. At least a dozen of these techniques have been devised, and they are continually being refined. Not only can they be aimed at particular genes, but they can be applied to the entire genome to estimate the fraction of our genes that have been targets of recent natural selection. These analyses have delivered a surprise. As the geneticist Joshua Akey concluded in a stringent 2009 review, the number of strong selective events thought to exist in the human genome today is considerably more than that imagined less than a decade ago. Approximately 8% of the genome has been influenced by positive selection, and an even larger fraction may have been subject to more modest selective pressure. Many of the selected genes involve the functioning of the nervous system, so they could, in theory, affect cognition or emotion. The pattern of selection, moreover, differs among populations. Some journalists have uncomprehendingly lauded these results as a refutation of evolutionary psychology and what they see as its politically dangerous implication of a human nature shaped by adaptation to a hunter-gatherer lifestyle. In fact, the evidence for recent selection, if it applies to genes with effects on cognition and emotion, would license a far more radical form of evolutionary psychology, one in which minds have been biologically shaped by recent environments in addition to ancient ones. And it could have the incendiary implication that Aboriginal and immigrant populations are less biologically adapted to the demands of modern life than populations that have lived in literate state societies for millennia. The fact that a hypothesis is politically uncomfortable does not mean that it is false, but it does mean that we should consider the evidence very carefully before concluding that it is true. Is there any reason to believe that declines in violence in particular societies can be attributed to genetic changes in their members? The neurobiology of violence is a target-rich area for natural selection. Selective breeding of mice for 4 or 5 generations can produce a strain that is markedly more or less aggressive than an off-the-shelf lab mouse. Violence in humans, of course, is fantastically more complicated than violence in mice, but if variations among people in their inclinations toward or away from violence are heritable, selection could certainly favor whichever variants result in more surviving offspring, which would change the concentration of the inciting and pacifying genes over time. So, first we must establish whether any portion of the variation in aggression among people is caused by variation in their genes. That is, whether aggression is heritable. Heritability may be measured in at least 3 ways. One is to look at correlations in traits between identical twins who have been separated at birth and reared apart. They share their genes, but not their family environments, within the range of environments in the sample. A second is to see whether there is a higher correlation between identical twins, who share all their genes and most of their family environments, than between fraternal twins, who share only half their variable genes and most of their family environments. The third is to see whether there is a greater correlation between biological siblings, who share half their genes and most of their family environments, than between adopted siblings, who share none of their variable genes and most of their family environments. Each of the methods has strengths and weaknesses. For example, identical twins may become partners in crime more often than fraternal twins, but the strengths and weaknesses are different among the three. So if the methods converge, there are good grounds for believing that the trait in question is heritable. These methods have shown that having an antisocial personality and getting into trouble with the law have a substantial heritable component, though their effects sometimes depend on features of the environment. In a large 1984 study of Danish adoptees, among the adolescents and young adults who had been brought up in families in which an adoptive parent had been convicted of a crime, about 25% of the biological offspring of criminals had been convicted of a crime, whereas only 15% of the biological offspring of non-criminals had been convicted. In that study, the effect of biological relatedness was seen only in non-violent crimes such as auto theft. So in the 1980s, many textbooks said that only non-violent criminality was heritable, not a tendency to violence itself. But the conclusion was premature. There are far fewer criminal convictions of violent than non-violent crimes, so the sample size for the violent crimes is smaller, and the ability to detect heritability weaker. Also, conviction rates are buffeted by vicissitudes of the criminal justice system that may overwhelm the effects of an offender's violent tendencies. Today's studies use more sensitive measures of violence, including confidential self-reports, validated scales of aggression and antisocial behavior, and ratings by teachers, friends, and parents. For example, whether the person being rated hurts others for his or her own advantage, or deliberately frightens and causes discomfort in others. All of the measures correlate with the probability of being convicted of a violent crime, while providing far more plentiful data. When they are analyzed with the tools of behavioral genetics, all three methods reveal substantial heritability of aggressive tendencies. The analysis of twins separated at birth is the rarest method in behavioral genetics, because nowadays few twins are separated at birth. But the largest of the studies, based at the University of Minnesota, looked at aggression in identical twins reared apart and found a heritability coefficient of 0.38, which means that about 38% of the variation in aggression in the sample can be explained by variation in their genes. Adoption studies are somewhat more common, and one of the better ones estimated the heritability of aggressive behavior in its sample as 0.70. Studies that compare identical and fraternal twins on aggressive tendencies such as arguing, fighting, threatening, destroying property, and disobeying parents and teachers tend to yield estimates of heritability between 0.4 and 0.6, particularly in childhood and adulthood. In adolescence, the influence of peers often overshadows the influence of genes. The behavioral geneticists Soo-Hyun Ree and Erwin Waldman recently reviewed the entire research literature on the genetics of aggression, which includes more than 100 twin and adoption studies. They selected 19 that met stringent criteria of research quality and that specifically zeroed in on aggressive actions such as physical fighting, cruelty to animals, and bullying, rather than the broader category of antisocial tendencies. They also examined all the published twin and adoption studies of criminal arrests and convictions. They estimated the heritability of aggressive behavior at around 0.44, and the heritability of criminality at around 0.75, of which 0.33 consists of additive heritability, that is, variation that breeds true, and 0.42 consists of non-additive heritability, variation caused by interactions among genes. Though their data set on criminality did not distinguish violent from nonviolent crimes, they cited a Danish twin study that separated the two and that yielded a heritability estimate of 0.50 for the violent ones. As in most studies in behavioral genetics, the effects of being brought up in a given family were tiny to non-existent, though other aspects of the environment that are not easily measurable by these techniques, such as effects of the neighborhood, subculture, or idiosyncratic personal experiences, undoubtedly do have effects. The exact numbers should not be taken too seriously, but the fact that they are all substantially above zero should be. Behavioral genetics confirms that aggressive tendencies can be inherited, and that gives natural selection material to work with in shifting the average violent tendencies of a population. Heritability is a necessary condition for evolutionary change, but it measures a hodgepodge of diverse contributors to behavior. When we tease them apart, we find many specific pathways by which natural selection could adjust our inclinations toward or away from violence. Let's consider a few. Self-domestication and pedomorphy. Richard Wrangham has noted that the domestication of animals usually tames them by slowing down components of the developmental timetable to retain juvenile traits into adulthood, a process called pedomorphy or neoteny. Domesticated strains and species tend to have more childlike skulls and faces, to show fewer sex differences, to be more playful, and to be less aggressive. These changes can be seen in farm animals that have been deliberately domesticated, such as horses, cattle, goats, and foxes, and in one species of wolf that was self-domesticated after it started to hang around human campsites thousands of years ago, scrounging leftover food, and eventually evolved into dogs. And in Chapter 2, we saw that bonobos evolved from a chimpanzee-like ancestor via a process of pedomorphy after their foraging ecology had reduced the payoff for aggression in males. Based on pedomorphic changes in the fossils of Paleolithic humans, Wrangham has suggested that a similar process has been taking place in human evolution during the past 30 to 50,000 years, and may still be taking place. Brain structure. The neuroscientist Paul Thompson has shown that the distribution of gray matter in the cerebral cortex, including the dorsolateral prefrontal region, is highly heritable. It is almost identical in identical twins, and considerably less similar in fraternal twins. So is the distribution of white matter connecting the frontal cortex to other regions of the brain. It is possible, then, that the frontal lobe circuitry that implements self-control varies genetically among individuals, making it eligible for recent natural selection. Oxytocin, the so-called cuddle hormone, which encourages sympathy and trust, acts on receptors in several parts of the brain, and the number and distribution of those receptors can have dramatic effects on behavior. In a famous experiment, biologists inserted a gene for the receptor for vasopressin, a hormone similar to oxytocin that operates in the brains of males, into meadow voles, an aggressive and promiscuous species that lacks it. Hygamous, hogamous, the voles were monogamous, just like their evolutionary cousins, the prairie voles, which come with the receptors pre-installed. The experiment suggests that simple genetic changes in the oxytocin-vasopressin system can have profound effects on sympathy, bonding, and by extension, the inhibition of aggression. Testosterone. A person's response to a challenge of dominance depends in part on the amount of testosterone released into the bloodstream and on the distribution of receptors for the hormone in his or her brain. The gene for the testosterone receptor varies across individuals, so a given concentration of testosterone can have a stronger effect on the brains of some people than others. Men with genes that code for more sensitive versions of the receptor have a greater surge of testosterone when conversing with an attractive woman, which can lead to reduced fear and greater risk-taking, and in one study were overrepresented in a sample of convicted rapists and murderers. The genetic pathways that regulate testosterone are complicated, but they offer a target by which natural selection could alter people's willingness to take up aggressive challenges. Neurotransmitters are the molecules that are released from a neuron, seep across a microscopic gap, and lock onto a receptor in the surface of another neuron, changing its activity and thereby allowing patterns of neural firing to propagate through the brain. One major class of neurotransmitters are the catecholamines, which include dopamine, serotonin, and norepinephrine, also called noradrenaline, and related to the adrenaline that triggers the fight-or-flight response. The catecholamines are used in several motivational and emotional systems of the brain, and their concentration is regulated by proteins that break them down or recycle them. One of those enzymes is monoamine oxidase A, MAOA for short, which helps to break down these neurotransmitters, preventing them from building up in the brain. When they do build up, the organism can become hyperactive to threats and more likely to engage in aggression. The first sign that MAOA can affect violence in humans was the discovery of a Dutch family that carried a rare mutation that left half the men without a working version of the gene. The gene is found on the X chromosome, which men have only one of. So if a man's MAOA gene is defective, he has no backup copy to compensate. Over at least five generations, the affected men in the family were prone to aggressive outbursts. One, for example, forced his sisters to disrobe at knife point. Another tried to run over his boss with his car. A more common kind of variation is found in the part of the gene that determines how much MAOA is produced. People with a low activity version of the gene build up higher levels of dopamine, serotonin, and norepinephrine in the brain. They also are more likely to have symptoms of antisocial personality disorder, to report that they have committed acts of violence, to be convicted of a violent crime, to have amygdalas that react more strongly, and an orbital cortex that reacts less strongly to angry and fearful faces, and, in the psychology lab, to force a fellow participant to drink hot sauce if they think he has exploited them. Unlike many other genes that affect behavior, the low-activity version of the MAOA gene seems to be fairly specific to aggression. It does not correlate well with any other personality trait. The low-activity version of the MAOA gene makes people more prone to aggression primarily when they have grown up with stressful experiences, such as having been abused or neglected by their parents, or having been held back in school. It's hard to pinpoint the exact stressors that have this effect, because stressful lives are often stressful in many ways at once. In fact, the modulating factor may consist of other genes which are shared with an abusive parent, predisposing both parent and child to aggression, and which may also elicit negative reactions from the people around him. But whatever the modifying factor is, it does not turn the effects of the low-activity version of the gene upside down. In all the studies, the gene has an aggregate or main effect in the population that could make it a target of selection. Indeed, Moffitt and Caspi, who first discovered that the effect of the gene depends on stressful experiences, suggest that rather than thinking of the low-activity version of the gene as a contributor to violence, we should think of the high-activity version as an inhibitor of violence. It protects people from overreacting to a stress-filled life. Geneticists have discovered statistical evidence of selection for the MAOA gene in humans, though the evidence does not single out the low or high activity variant, nor does it prove that the gene was selected for its effects on aggression. Other genes that affect dopamine have been associated with delinquency as well, including a version of a gene that affects the density of dopamine receptors, DRD2, and a version of a gene for a dopamine transporter, DAT1, that mops up excess dopamine from the synapse and transports it back into the neurons that release it. Any of them could be a fair game for rapid natural selection. Genetic tendencies toward or away from violence, then, could have been selected during the historical transitions we have examined. The question is, were they? The mere existence of pathways to evolutionary change does not prove that those pathways were taken. Evolution depends not just on the genetic raw material, but on factors such as the demography of a population, including both sheer numbers and the degree to which they have absorbed immigrants from other groups, the role of the genetic and environmental dice, and the dilution of genetic effects by learned adjustments to the cultural milieu. So is there evidence that the pacification or civilizing process ever rendered the pacified or civilized peoples constitutionally less susceptible to violence? Casual impressions can be misleading. History offers many examples in which one nation has considered another to be peopled by savages or barbarians, but the impressions were motivated more by racism and observations of differences in societal type than by any attempt to tease apart nature and nurture. Between 1788 and 1868, 168,000 British convicts were sent to penal colonies in Australia, and one might have expected that Australians today would have inherited the obstreperous traits of their founding population. But Australia's homicide rate is lower than that of the mother country. In fact, it is one of the lowest in the world. Before 1945, the Germans had a reputation as the most militaristic people on earth. Today, they may be the most pacifistic. What about hard evidence from the revolution in evolutionary genomics? In their manifesto, The 10,000-Year Explosion, How Civilization Accelerated Human Evolution, the physicist Gregory Cochran and the anthropologist Henry Harpending reviewed the evidence for recent selection in humans and speculated that it includes changes in temperament and behavior. But none of the selected genes they describe has been implicated in behavior. All are restricted to digestion, disease resistance, and skin pigmentation. I know of only two claims of recent evolutionary changes in violence that have at least a soupçon of scientific evidence behind them. One involves the Maori, a Polynesian people who settled in New Zealand about 1,000 years ago. Like many non-state hunter horticulturalists, the Maori engaged in extensive warfare, including a genocide of the Moriori people in the nearby Chatham Islands. Today, their culture preserves many symbols of their warrior past, including the haka war dance that fires up New Zealand's All Blacks rugby team, and an armamentarium of beautiful greenstone weapons. I have a lovely battle axe in my office, a gift of the University of Auckland, for giving a set of lectures there. The acclaimed 1994 film Once Were Warriors vividly depicts the crime and domestic violence that currently plagues some of the Maori communities in New Zealand. Against this cultural backdrop, the New Zealand press quickly picked up on a 2005 report showing that the low-activity version of the MAOA gene is more common among the Maori, 70%, than among descendants of Europeans, 40%. The lead geneticist, Rod Lee, suggested that the gene had been selected in the Maori because it made them more accepting of risk during the arduous canoe voyages that brought them to New Zealand, and more effective in their internecine tribal battles thereafter. The press dubbed it the warrior gene, and speculated that it could help explain the higher levels of social pathology among the Maori in modern New Zealand. The warrior gene theory has not fared well in warfare with skeptical scientists. One problem is that the signatures of selection for the gene could also have been caused by a genetic bottleneck, in which a random assortment of genes that happened to be carried by a few founders of a population was multiplied in their burgeoning descendants. Another is that the low-activity version of the gene is even more common in Chinese men, 77% of whom carry it, and the Chinese are neither descended from warriors in their recent history, nor particularly prone to social pathology in modern societies. A third and related problem is that an association between the gene and aggression has not been found in non-European populations, perhaps because they have evolved other ways of regulating their catecholamine levels. Genes often act in networks regulated by feedback loops, so in populations in which a particular gene is less effective, other genes may step up their activity to compensate. For now, the warrior gene theory is staggering around with possibly fatal wounds. The other claim of a recent evolutionary change appeals to a civilizing rather than a pacification process. In A Farewell to Alms, A Brief Economic History of the World, Gregory Clark sought to explain the timing and location of the Industrial Revolution, which, for the first time in history, increased material well-being faster than the increase could be eaten up by population growth. Why, Clark asked, was it England that hosted this one-time escape from the Malthusian trap? The answer, he suggested, was that the nature of Englishmen had changed. Starting around 1250, when England began to shift from a knightly society to a nation of shopkeepers, as Napoleon would sneeringly call it, the wealthier commoners had more surviving children than the poorer ones, presumably because they married younger and could afford better food and cleaner living conditions. Clark calls it the survival of the richest. The rich got richer and they got children. This upper middle class was also out reproducing the aristocrats, who were splitting heads and chopping off body parts in their tournaments and private wars. Since the economy as a whole would not begin to expand until the 19th century, the extra surviving children of the wealthier merchants and tradesmen had nowhere to go on the economic ladder but downward. They continuously replaced the poorer commoners, bringing with them their bourgeois traits of thrift, hard work, self-control, patient future discounting, and avoidance of violence. The population of England literally evolved middle-class values. That in turn positioned them to take advantage of the commercial opportunities opened up by the innovations of the Industrial Revolution. Though Clark occasionally dodges the political correctness police by noting that nonviolence and self-control can be passed from parent to child as cultural habits, in a précis of his book entitled Genetically Capitalist, he offers the full-strength version of his thesis. The highly capitalist nature of English society by 1800, individualism, low time preference rates, long work hours, high levels of human capital, may thus stem from the nature of the Darwinian struggle in a very stable agrarian society in the long run up to the Industrial Revolution. The triumph of capitalism in the modern world thus may lie as much in our genes as in ideology or rationality. A Farewell to Arms is filled with illuminating statistics and gripping narratives about the historical precursors to the Industrial Revolution. But the genetically capitalist theory has not competed well in the struggle for survival among theories of economic growth. One problem is that until recently, the rich have out-reproduced the poor in pretty much every society, not just the one that later blasted off in an industrial revolution. Another is that while aristocrats and royals may have had no more legitimate heirs than the bourgeoisie, they more than made up for it in bastards, which could have contributed a disproportionate share of their genes to the next generation. A third is that when institutions change, a nation can vault to spectacular rates of economic growth in the absence of a recent history of selection for middle-class values, such as post-war Japan and post-communist China. And most important, Clark cites no data showing that the English are innately more self-controlled or less violent than the citizenries of countries that did not host an industrial revolution. So while recent biological evolution may, in theory, have tweaked our inclinations toward violence and nonviolence, we have no good evidence that it actually has. At the same time, we do have good evidence for changes that could not possibly be genetic, because they unfolded on timescales that are too rapid to be explained by natural selection, even with the new understanding of how recently it has acted. The abolition of slavery and cruel punishments during the humanitarian revolution, the reduction of violence against minorities, women, children, homosexuals, and animals during the rights revolutions, and the plummeting of war and genocide during the Long Peace and the New Peace, all unfolded over a span of decades or even years, sometimes within a single generation. A particularly dramatic decline is the near halving of the homicide rate during the Great American Crime Decline of the 1990s. The decay rate of that decline, around 7% a year, is powerful enough to drag a measure of violence down to 1% of its original level over just two generations, all without the slightest change in gene frequencies. Since it is indisputable that cultural and social inputs can adjust the settings of our better angels, such as self-control and empathy, and thereby control our violent inclinations, we have the means to explain all the declines of violence without invoking recent biological evolution. At least for the time being, we have no need for that hypothesis. Morality and taboo. The world has far too much morality. If you added up all the homicides committed in pursuit of self-help justice, the casualties of religious and revolutionary wars, the people executed for victimless crimes and misdemeanors, and the targets of ideological genocides, they would surely outnumber the fatalities from amoral predation and conquest. The human moral sense can excuse any atrocity in the minds of those who commit it, and furnishes them with motives for acts of violence that bring them no tangible benefit. The torture of heretics and conversos, the burning of witches, the imprisonment of homosexuals, and the honor killing of unchaste sisters and daughters are just a few examples. The incalculable suffering that has been visited on the world by people motivated by a moral cause is enough to make one sympathize with the comedian George Carlin when he said, "I think motivation is overrated. You show me some lazy prick who's lying around all day watching game shows and stroking his penis, and I'll show you someone who's not causing any fucking trouble." Though the next contribution of the human moral sense to human well-being may well be negative, on those occasions when it is suitably deployed, it can claim some monumental advances, including the humanitarian reforms of the Enlightenment and the rights revolutions of recent decades. When it comes to virulent ideologies, morality may be the disease, but morality is also the cure. The mentality of taboo, like the mentality of morality of which it is part, also can pull in either direction. It can turn religious or sexual nonconformity into an outrage that calls for ghastly punishment, but it can also prevent the mind from sliding into dangerous territory such as wars of conquest, the use of chemical and nuclear weapons, dehumanizing racial stereotypes, casual allusions to rape, and the taking of identifiable human lives. How can we make sense of this crazy angel, the part of human nature that would seem to have the strongest claim to be the source of our goodness, but that in practice can be more diabolical than our worst inner demon? To understand the role of the moral sense in the decline of violence, we have to solve a number of psychological enigmas. One is how people in different times and cultures can be driven by goals that they experience as moral, but that are unrecognizable to our own standards of morality. Another is why the moral sense does not, in general, push toward the reduction of suffering, but so often increases it. A third is how the moral sense can be so compartmentalized, why upstanding citizens can beat their wives and children, while liberal democracies can practice slavery and colonial oppression, why Nazi Germany could treat animals with unequaled kindness. A fourth is why, for better or worse, morality can be extended to thoughts as well as deeds, leading to the paradox of taboo. And the overriding puzzle, of course, is, what changed? What degree of freedom in the human moral sense has been engaged by the processes of history to drive violence downward? The starting point is to distinguish morality per se, a topic in philosophy, in particular normative ethics, from the human moral sense, a topic in psychology. Unless one is a radical moral relativist, one believes that people can, in some sense, be mistaken about their moral convictions, that their justifications of genocide, rape, honor killings, and the torture of heretics are erroneous, not just distasteful, to our sensibilities. Whether one is a moral realist and believes that moral truths are objectively out there somewhere, like mathematical truths, or simply allows that moral statements have some degree of warrant in terms of consistency with universally held convictions, or the best understanding that arises out of our collective rational deliberation, one can distinguish questions of morality from questions of moral psychology. The latter ask about the mental processes that people experience as moral, and they can be studied in the lab and field, just like any other cognitive or emotional faculty. The next step in understanding the moral sense is to recognize that it is a distinctive mode of thinking about an action, not just the avoidance of an action. There are important psychological distinctions between avoiding an action because it is deemed immoral, killing is wrong, and avoiding it because it is merely disagreeable. I hate cauliflower, unfashionable, bell bottoms are out, or imprudent, don't scratch mosquito bites. One difference is that disapproval of a moralized act is universalized. If you think cauliflower is distasteful, then whether other people eat it is of no concern to you. But if you think that murder and torture and rape are immoral, then you cannot simply avoid these activities yourself and be indifferent to whether other people indulge in them. You have to disapprove of anyone committing such acts. Second, moralized beliefs are actionable. While people may not unfailingly carry out Socrates' dictum that to know the good is to do the good, they tacitly aspire to it. People see moral actions as intrinsically worthy goals, which need no ulterior motive. If people believe that murder is immoral, they don't need to be paid or even esteemed to refrain from murdering someone. When people do breach a moral precept, they rationalize the failure by invoking some countervailing precept, by finding an exculpatory excuse, or by acknowledging that the failure is a regrettable personal weakness. Other than devils and storybook villains, no one says, "I believe murder is a heinous atrocity, and I do it whenever it serves my purposes." Finally, moral infractions are punishable. If one believes that murder is wrong, one is not just entitled to see a murderer punished, but one is obligated to make it happen. One may not, as we say, let someone get away with murder. Now just substitute idolatry, or homosexuality, or blasphemy, or subversion, or indecency, or insubordination for murder. And you can see how the human moral sense can be a major force for evil. Another design feature of the moral sense is that many moral convictions operate as norms and taboos rather than as principles the believer can articulate and defend. In the psychologist Lawrence Kohlberg's famous six-stage progression of moral development, from a child's avoidance of punishment to a philosopher's universal principles, the middle two stages, which many people never get out of, consist of conforming to norms to be a good boy or girl, and maintaining conventions to preserve social stability. When reasoning through the moral dilemma that Kohlberg made famous, in which Heinz must break into a drugstore to steal an overpriced drug that will save his dying wife, people in these stages can muster no better justification for their answers than that Heinz shouldn't steal the drug because stealing is bad and illegal and he is not a criminal, or that Heinz should steal the drug because that's what a good husband does. Fewer people can articulate a principled justification, such as that human life is a cardinal value that trumps social norms, social stability, or obedience to the law. The psychologist Jonathan Haidt has underscored the ineffability of moral norms in a phenomenon he calls moral dumbfounding. Often people have an instant intuition that an action is immoral and then struggle, often unsuccessfully, to come up with reasons why it is immoral. When Haidt asked participants, for example, whether it would be all right for a brother and sister to have voluntary protected sex, for a person to clean a toilet with a discarded American flag, for a family to eat a pet dog that had been killed by a car, for a man to buy a dead chicken and have sex with it, or for a person to break a deathbed vow to visit the grave of his mother, they said no in each case. But when asked for justifications, they floundered ineffectually before giving up and saying, "I don't know. I can't explain it. I just know it's wrong." Moral norms, even when ineffable, can sometimes be effective brakes on violent behavior. In the modern West, as we have seen, the avoidance of some kinds of violence, such as mercy killing an abandoned child, retaliating for an insult, and declaring war on another developed state, consist not in weighing the moral issues, empathizing with the targets, or restraining an impulse, but in not having the violent act as a live option in the mind at all. The act is not considered and avoided. It is unthinkable or laughable. The combination of radical cultural differences in which behaviors are moralized with moral dumbfounding in our own culture may create the impression that norms and taboos are arbitrary, that there may be a culture out there somewhere in which it is immoral to utter a sentence with an even number of words or to deny that the ocean is boiling hot. But the anthropologist Richard Schweder and several of his students and collaborators have found that moral norms across the world cluster around a small number of themes. The intuitions that we in the modern West tend to think of as the core of morality, fairness, justice, the protection of individuals, and the prevention of harm, are just one of several spheres of concern that may attach themselves to the cognitive and emotional paraphernalia of moralization. Even a glance at ancient religions like Judaism, Islam, and Hinduism reminds us that they moralize a slew of other concerns such as loyalty, respect, obedience, asceticism, and the regulation of bodily functions like eating, sex, and menstruation. Schweder organized the world's moral concerns in a threefold way. Autonomy, the ethic we recognize in the modern West, assumes that the social world is composed of individuals and that the purpose of morality is to allow them to exercise their choices and to protect them from harm. The ethic of community, in contrast, sees the social world as a collection of tribes, clans, families, institutions, guilds, and other coalitions, and equates morality with duty, respect, loyalty, and interdependence. The ethic of divinity posits that the world is composed of a divine essence, portions of which are housed in bodies, and that the purpose of morality is to protect this spirit from degradation and contamination. If a body is merely a container for the soul, which ultimately belongs to or is part of a god, then people do not have the right to do what they want with their bodies. They are obligated to avoid polluting them by refraining from unclean forms of sex, food, and other physical pleasures. The ethic of divinity lies behind the moralization of disgust and the valorization of purity and asceticism. Hate took Schwedter's trichotomy and cleaved two of the ethics in two, yielding a total of five concerns that he called moral foundations. Community was bifurcated into in-group loyalty and authority/respect, and autonomy was sundered into fairness/reciprocity, the morality behind reciprocal altruism, and harm/care, the cultivation of kindness and compassion, and the inhibition of cruelty and aggression. Hate also gave divinity the more secular label purity/sanctity. In addition to these adjustments, Hate beefed up the case that the moral foundations are universal by showing that all five spheres may be found in the moral intuitions of secular Westerners. In his dumbfounding scenarios, for example, purity/sanctity underlay the participant's revulsion to incest, bestiality, and the eating of a family pet. Authority/respect commanded them to visit a mother's grave, and in-group loyalty prohibited them from desecrating an American flag. The system I find most useful was developed by the anthropologist Alan Fiske. It proposes that moralization comes out of four relational models, each a distinct way in which people conceive of their relationships. The theory aims to explain how people in a given society apportion resources, where their moral obsessions came from in our evolutionary history, how morality varies across societies, and how people can compartmentalize their morality and protect it with taboos. The relational models line up with the classifications of Schwedter and Hate. The first model, communal sharing, communality for short, combines in-group loyalty with purity/sanctity. When people adopt the mindset of communality, they freely share resources within the group, keeping no tabs on who gives or takes how much. They conceptualize the group as one flesh, unified by a common essence, which must be safeguarded against contamination. They reinforce the intuition of unity with rituals of bonding and merging, such as bodily contact, commensal meals, synchronized movement, chanting or praying in unison, shared emotional experiences, common bodily ornamentation or mutilation, and the mingling of bodily fluids in nursing, sex, and blood rituals. They also rationalize it with myths of shared ancestry, descent from a patriarch, rootedness in a territory, or relatedness to a totemic animal. Communality evolved from maternal care, kin selection, and mutualism, and it may be implemented in the brain, at least in part, by the oxytocin system. Fiske's second relational model, authority ranking, is a linear hierarchy defined by dominance, status, age, gender, size, strength, wealth, or precedence. It entitles superiors to take what they want and to receive tribute from inferiors, and to command their obedience and loyalty. It also obligates them to a paternalistic, pastoral, or noblesse oblige responsibility to protect those under them. Presumably, it evolved from primate dominance hierarchies, and it may be implemented in part by testosterone-sensitive circuits in the brain. Equality matching embraces tit-for-tat reciprocity and other schemes to divide resources equitably, such as turn-taking, coin-flipping, matching contributions, division into equal portions, and verbal formulas like eeny, meeny, miny, mo. Few animals engage in clear-cut reciprocity, though chimpanzees have a rudimentary sense of fairness, at least when it comes to themselves being short-changed. The neural bases of equality matching embrace the parts of the brain that register intentions, cheating, conflict, perspective taking, and calculation, which include the insula, orbital cortex, cingulate cortex, dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, parietal cortex, and temporoparietal junction. Equality matching is the basis of our sense of fairness and our intuitive economics, and it binds us as neighbors, colleagues, acquaintances, and trading partners, rather than as bosom buddies or brothers in arms. Many traditional tribes engaged in the ritual exchange of useless gifts, a bit like our Christmas fruitcakes, solely to cement equality-matching relationships. Those who are comparing and contrasting the taxonomies may wonder why Hate's category of harm/care is adjacent to fairness and aligned with Fisk's equality matching, rather than with more touchy-feely relationships like community or sanctity. The reason is that hate measures harm/care by asking people about the treatment of a generic someone, rather than the friends and relatives that are the standard beneficiaries of caring. The responses to these questions align perfectly with the responses to his questions about fairness, and that is no coincidence. Recall that the logic of reciprocal altruism, which implements our sense of fairness, is to be nice by cooperating on the first move, by not defecting unless defected on, and by conferring a large benefit to a needy stranger when one can do so at a relatively small cost to oneself. When care and harm are extended outside intimate circles, then they are simply a part of the logic of fairness. Fisk's final relational model is market pricing, the system of currency, prices, rents, salaries, benefits, interest, credit, and derivatives that powers a modern economy. Market pricing depends on numbers, mathematical formulas, accounting, digital transfers, and the language of formal contracts. Unlike the other three relational models, market pricing is nowhere near universal, since it depends on literacy, numeracy, and other recently invented information technologies. The logic of market pricing remains cognitively unnatural as well, as we saw in the widespread resistance to interest and profits until the modern era. One can line up the models, Fisk notes, along a scale that more or less reflects their order of emergence in evolution. Child development and history. Communal sharing leads to authority ranking, leads to equality matching, leads to market pricing. Market pricing, it seems to me, is specific neither to markets nor to pricing. It really should be lumped with other examples of formal social organization that have been honed over the centuries as a good way for millions of people to manage their affairs in a technologically advanced society, but which may not occur spontaneously to untutored minds. One of these institutions is the political apparatus of democracy, where power is assigned not to a strong man, authority, but to representatives who are selected by a formal voting procedure and whose prerogatives are delineated by a system of laws. Another is a corporation, university, or nonprofit organization. The people who work in them aren't free to hire their friends and relations, communality, or to dole out spoils as favors, equality matching, but are hemmed in by fiduciary duties and regulations. My emendation of Fisk's theory does not come out of the blue. Fisk notes that one of his intellectual inspirations for market pricing was the sociologist Max Weber's concept of a rational legal, as opposed to traditional and charismatic mode of social legitimation, a system of norms that is worked out by reason and implemented by formal rules. Accordingly, I will sometimes refer to this relational model using the more general term rational legal. For all their differences in lumping and splitting, the theories of Schwedter, Haight, and Fisk agree on how the moral sense works. No society defines every virtue and wrongdoing by the golden rule or the categorical imperative. Instead, morality consists in respecting or violating one of the relational models, or ethics or foundations, betraying, exploiting, or subverting a coalition, contaminating oneself or one's community, defying or insulting a legitimate authority, harming someone without provocation, taking a benefit without paying the cost, peculating funds or abusing prerogatives. The point of these taxonomies is not to pigeonhole entire societies, but to provide a grammar for social norms. The grammar should reveal common patterns beneath the differences among cultures and periods, including the decline of violence, and should predict people's response to infractions of the reigning norms, including their perverse genius for moral compartmentalization. Some social norms are merely solutions to coordination games, such as driving on the right-hand side of the road, using paper currency, and speaking the ambient language. But most norms have moral content. Each moralized norm is a compartment containing a relational model, one or more social roles, parent, child, teacher, student, husband, wife, supervisor, employee, customer, neighbor, stranger, a context, home, street, school, workplace, and a resource, food, money, land, housing, time, advice, sex, labor. To be a socially competent member of a culture is to have assimilated a large set of these norms. Take friendship. Couples who are close